McManus. I'm a Los Angeles-based theater critic for TotalTheater.com and a playwright as well, with a play opening in North Hollywood. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom, everybody. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am delighted to be talking to a writer and a theater person. Not only is this man a theater critic for places like TotalTheater.com, covering Los Angeles theater and environs, he's also written novels, including the book on which the band name Mott the Hoople came from, and a book called The Pigskin Rabbi, which bothers me a little bit, but we'll talk. Please welcome to the neighborhood the author of the play Marlena, running now in North Hollywood, Willard Manis. Shalom, Willard.
Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Shalom, and how do you do? How are you, Will?
I'm good. I'm very well. Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be talking to you about theater and whatever else you're interested in.
Oh, well, I'm interested in girls, but we won't talk about that. No, we're going to talk
about that on the air.
Once we get off the air, we'll schmooze. We'll talk. But let's talk somewhat seriously about the work that you have done. Now, your book, Mott the Hoople, goes all the way back to 1966. So how old are you, by the way?
I'll be 87 in September.
Mit Mazel, you don't sound a day over 84. So how do you do it? How do you feel?
I feel about 95.
No, are you healthy, or do you have problems, or you sound wonderful?
I'm in good shape, really. I still play a fast game of paddle tennis 3 times a week, much to my own amazement, and I'm playing against players who are usually a third my age. Not that I'm one of the top players, but I can hold my own.
Good.
So, thank God, I'm in pretty good health, and that goes to my wife as well, who just celebrated her 88th birthday.
Oh, mit Mazel, mit Glück on both. Let me tell you something. I'm quite a bit younger than you are, but I can barely hold my schmeckle when I make a tinkle, and you can play racket tennis. I think this is a wonderful thing.
So, thank you.
Mazel to you on that. And I have to ask, because you got a lot of people who are named Will, for William, but
yes.
did you take any shit for being named Willard, especially when the Rat movie came out?
No, I don't remember that. That was never a factor in my life. Though when I was younger and in the Bronx neighborhood, they used to call me Willie, which was okay with me, not great. But a lot of my old friends know me as Willie. But around here, I'm Will, and now that I'm a senior citizen.
So is Will your preferred name, or do you really like Willard? Because that's how you identify yourself.
I identify myself in my reviews and playwriting credits and novel credits and so on as Willard Manis. But otherwise, my friends call me Will, and I hope you will as well.
I will call you Will. How's that? That's good. Especially if you put me in your Will. Little comedy there. Let me ask, was Mott the Hoople your first novel? Were there others in the drawer, others published?
My first novel was published in 1957, and it was called The Fixers. It was based on the basketball scandals in New York City of the 1950s, the point-shaving scandals. I don't know if you know much about it, but several of the big universities like NYU and CCNY and LIU, who were basketball powerhouses then, had players who got caught up with the gamblers and started shaving points for them. The scandal also affected schools like Kentucky and school out in the Midwest, I forget which one. I mean, it was a big thing in the 50s. So my first novel was a fictionalized version of that scandal, more or less based on City College, which I called Public College in the novel. So it was a sports novel, kind of ahead of its time. There weren't many sports novels then, but that was my first book published in 1957.
Now let me ask you, was it difficult to get a publisher at that point? Or you wrote it, you sent it, and they said, oh, yes.
It was difficult because at that time, sports fiction was considered uncommercial by most of the big publishing houses. So So it took a couple of years, but I found a paperback original house called Ace Books, which was in business then, and they put it out as a mass market paperback book. It was published by them.
But did it do well once it was published?
It sold the first edition, but that's all. They didn't push the book. They spent no money on publicity or advertising or anything like that. They just shoved the books out, you know, into the markets that they dealt with, and that was it. So, no, I can't say it did really well, but at least it sold out the first edition.
Huh.
That was respectable.
So did that give you the impetus to say, oh, okay, I've got another novel in me after
yes,
that one?
But, you know, I had begun writing fiction when I was in college, and I continued when I graduated. So my goal always was to become a novelist, and I published The Fixers, and then I started work on Mata Hoople, and that became a long, long slog for me as a writer. Something like 6 or 7 years went into that book. I first envisioned it as kind of equivalent of Rabelais, three big books, wild books, countercultural, with a crazy hero, Norman Mott, at the heart of it. And during the course of it, other books started coming out, like Catch-22 and so on, which took a lot of the impetus out of my original inspiration. So I cut it down to a single volume, which was finally published in 1966, and as you said, called Mott the Hoople. And later on, some maybe 7 or 8 years later, this British band took its name from my book, without any permission, I should say.
Well, they don't have to ask. It's a title.
They became pretty famous in the early 70s. Not the absolute top level of the rock world, but pretty close to it for about 2 or 3 years. Anyway, a lot of people around the world have heard of Mott the Hoople, and I meet people and they say, oh, you wrote the music for Mott the Hoople Band? And I always say, yes, I did. I wrote all their music.
Wouldn't it be funny if Ian Hunter sues you for defamation?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, actually, though, think about it. Having the band Mott the Hoople was just still well known. Did that maybe, even though they didn't give you credit or pay you or anything, did it help keep the book in print? Did you think it helped sell more copies of your book?
Unfortunately, only because of the stupidity of the British publisher. It was published in Britain as well as this country, Secker and Warburg. When the band name became well known, I wrote to them and said, look, you've got my novel. These guys have a hot band. Why don't you sell the book at the concerts? There's 10, 20, what, 25,000 people at some of their concerts. You can sell a lot of books. And I got back a message from the big guy saying, oh, we don't do things that way. So that whole big chance to sell a lot of copies of the book went down the tubes, unfortunately. Even though I had got terrific reviews when I was living on a Greek island, we can deal with that later if you want to.
Sure.
At the time when the book came out in England, and I got a telegram from the publicist of Secker and Warburg saying, congratulations, for the first time ever for us, a new work of fiction has had 3 rave reviews. In the 3 big Sunday papers. We should do well. Unfortunately, we did not do that well for whatever reason, and that's why I really tried to push them into connecting with the band concerts and selling books there, but they never took advantage of it, so again, it was a wasted opportunity.
But, again, since people still know and enjoy the music of Mott the Hoople,
what happened many years later in, say, about 15 years ago, I got a message from somebody who was publishing the Mott the Hoople quarterly, or, you know, a fanzine dedicated to the band, saying, we've been looking for you for 10 years. We had heard you were a recluse and living on a mountaintop in Greece. And now we want to make contact with you because there are all kinds of fans of the band who would like to buy your book.
Uh-huh.
So I told them, I have just come down from the mountain, and, you know, you're the first person I've dealt with in a while, but I will sit down for an interview. So So that interview in that fanzine led to hundreds of Martha Hoople fans contacting me to buy the book. I had a stash of the paperback edition of the book because that publisher had gone under. So I was able to sell all those books to those Martha Hoople fans out there. So that was sort of the rebirth of Martha Hoople. And it's now an e-book, so anybody who is a Martha Hoople fan and wants to read the book or has heard of the book can buy it online.
And you own the copyright. It's for you to say...
Copyright is mine because the publisher folded and the rights to the book reverted to me.
Mazel. What about some of the other books that you've gone on to write? Tell us, of course, please, about The Pigskin Rabbi.
Well, The Pigskin Rabbi was a fairly recent book. It was published, I guess, about 10 years ago, and it deals with a young dropout rabbi in New York. His father's a rabbi who was always a good football player. He had to hide his football prowess from his father, who didn't approve, and he ends up becoming quarterback of the New York Giants. So that's my fictional representation of the rabbinical world.
So it's sort of your jazz singer, in a manner of speaking.
A jazz singer, exactly. A friend of mine pointed that out. He said, you know, you followed the form of that book. And it was true. I did not have that in mind. But, you know, maybe subconsciously, yes, it was buried back there. You know, the hero's fight between the spiritual world, because he still respects the religion, of course. He hasn't rejected it. But he's pulled in the other direction by his football prowess, and he ends up running the team, and he brings in a friend of his to play wide receiver, and they communicate during the games by speaking Yiddish and, you know, have their secret code that way and so on. So it's a comic novel for sure. It was published by a small press, and we did well with that. Again, not a bestseller, but really well for a small press release.
Before we get to anything else, you are a Jewish person. How Jewish were you raised, and how Jewish are you now?
I was raised in a Jewish family in the Bronx. We did not keep kosher. My father was really somewhat of a rebel in his own right. His own father, back in the shtetl in Brest-Litovsk, evidently ran his own kind of synagogue, unofficial. I don't know all the details of that, but it was outside the normal arrangement for, you know, for rabbis and synagogues.
Right. It was a combination of synagogue and Hooters.
Yeah.
A great idea, I thought, yes.
Anyway, my father only went to the synagogue at holiday times, mostly to hear the liturgical singing. He loved the cantor singing. That was his big thing. But he was certainly Jewish, and it was a Jewish family, but we did not keep kosher.
Okay.
But I was pretty much a rebel. I consider myself Jewish, and I'm proud of it, but I am an atheist at heart, so I can't go along with a lot of the teachings, okay?
So you believe in Jewish culture to an extent, and your lineage.
I have great respect for Jewish culture, for rabbis who, and their study and learning and their erudition and so on, and for the spirit of the Jewish people. But again, I am not religious. I can't claim to be.
Now we are talking with Willard. I'm going to call you Willard Manischewitz, since we've gone through the Jewish. What was your Ellis Island, the family, before they hit the Bronx? Do you know?
You know, I think it was probably Manischewitz. My father...
Really?
much. It was hard to pull information out of him, but it probably was, yeah. And his story, just quickly, is very interesting.
Ooh.
He came to New York, and his father had preceded him. His father didn't speak a word of English and couldn't help him in New York, and his only landsman was located across the country in Butte, Montana. So at the age of 14, my father crossed the country by train by himself and ended up in Butte, Montana, where the landsman fixed him up with a horse and buggy, and he went up into the hills, the copper mines, every day and sold booze to the miners.
Wow, that is a story.
Yeah.
I wonder if he sold Manischewitz.
Yeah.
It'd be ironic if he sold Kedem, though. It wouldn't quite work.
Right.
But Will Manischewitz, what is your most recent novel that's been published? Are you working on any others, or are you more short form these days?
My most recent novel I published as an ebook because I could not find a publisher for it. It is called Love Under Aegean Skies, and it can be found on Amazon. And again, that came out of my many years spent in the Greek islands.
You spent like 20, 30 years living on Greece, like a Leonard Cohen character there.
I went to Greece on our honeymoon.
Yeah.
In 1961, I think it was, and we found our way to this village of Lindos on Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, intending to stay 3 days and ended up staying there 30 years.
First of all, did you have to make a living? Because you were making some money as a writer, but I can't imagine, or was it cheap?
I was certainly selling things as a writer. In those days in Greece, you didn't need much. The village of Lindos is an extraordinary, beautiful place, but at that time, it was still somewhat impoverished, left over from World War II, which was a very tough time for Greek people, especially in the islands. And we lived in a house with no running water or electricity.
Oy.
The rent was only $10 a month, 6 rooms in an interior courtyard.
So if you sold a story to some magazine, that was like a year's rent.
Almost. Well, listen, once I sold a travel article to the Worcester Telegram newspaper, got $7.50 back, and that paid for dinner for my wife, and we then had 2 kids and 2 friends of ours. So that's how cheap life was there. And that was a big factor for me as a budding writer. I knew if I wanted to become good, I had to work and work and work and keep writing. So it was a chance to, write full time and still not starve to death by staying in that Greek island village.
All right, but let me ask, you said you didn't have running water, right? So...
No, there was no running water or electricity. Water... You had a cistern in the courtyard for the water for your garden or dishes or whatever, but drinking water was delivered every day by a donkey guy with 4 big cans on the back of the donkey, and he filled up from the cistern in the main square with fresh water. And we lived like that for 3 or 4 years.
No, wait, but also, wait, did you piss in the ocean? What did you do about that stuff?
An outhouse. Each house had an outhouse, and it worked well. There was it was not easy. Don't get me wrong, Rabbi.
Yeah.
It was certainly a tough adjustment, and I didn't even think we could do it when we first moved into this house. But somehow we managed, and I was able to really turn out a lot of work, including finishing Marta Hoople and so on, getting that published. And living over there, there was only one telephone in the whole village, certainly no library, no research sources. To make quick money, I became a travel writer because I could write about the Greek islands.
Sure.
And we were right near the Turkish coast, so I could go to Turkey. So for many years, a lot of sustenance came out of my travel writing. I was still writing fiction and selling occasional stories. And Marta Hoople also had been optioned in Hollywood, and I got option money for about 5 or 6 years. So that helped us survive. But basically, I learned how to survive as a freelance writer over there.
That's amazing. Now, also, you said for about 4 years, you really lived rusty. I mean, did that change? Did you move to a place that had more amenities?
No. Finally, the economic situation in Greece change enough so that the government could then put in water, electricity to villages like Lindos. But it was slow coming, but it did happen, and we finally actually bought an old semi-ruined house there in 1970 and spent a year rebuilding it. And so when that was finished, everything was very comfortable. We had complete...
Sure.
I mean, water, heat, whatever, so those days of austerity were behind us.
Do you miss them sometimes? It's like what married couples say, when we were struggling, when we were poor, those were the best times, before the electricity and the indoor toilet.
I don't miss the lack of electricity so much, but I miss what we had first in Lindos, which at that time was pretty much an artist colony. There were about 25 or 30 artists or writers living there, foreigners, and about 500 Greeks. And it was a wonderful life. I learned how to spearfish, and we lived off the fish that I took, and things were quiet and beautiful and peaceful. But then mass tourism came in, beginning in the late 70s, and that has changed everything about Lindos, which is now a major Aegean tourist center with something like 15 or 20,000 visitors a day, and the hills all around it and within the village are covered with big hotels and so on. So the life has changed completely, but when my wife looked back and, you know, want to be nostalgic, we think of the times in the late 60s and 70s and so on, when things were different there. One of the bad factors was we were there when the Greek junta took over the country, the military dictatorship, and we actually lived under the dictatorship for 7 years, which was, you know, quite a powerful experience.
Did you ever have any problems or issues with the totalitarian government?
I didn't, because I was known as a journalist, my mail was certainly read, and, you know, I was being watched, but I was never faced with anything really bad, really violent or in any way. Most of the oppression was in the big cities, though certainly there was, you know, the junta was felt on the island, but because it was a tourist area by then, it wasn't the oppressive political climate that people in Athens and Thessalonica felt for many years. It was tough.
So what was the tipping point where you and your wife Mavis said, time to go back to America?
Well, mass tourism was certainly part of it. The crowds that came into Lindos, the noise, and a lot of people would come down and to this beautiful village and just drink there all day long and get really pissed, and fights in the streets. One time I came out one day, I couldn't get our front door open to push with all my might, and I found some British tourist had passed out during the night, was lying there in a pool of vomit, things like that. It was the noise factor, because people came down and it was a party town suddenly, and living there, in a way, was like living in a frat house.
Yeah.
So that was one factor that made us leave. But also, my mother back in New York, was becoming older and ill and couldn't take care of herself so well. And the education problem was another factor. So we suddenly realized at one point, hey, we have to leave. And that's when we came here. We got here in L.A. in 1979.
Also, you've been in California for a very long, long period of time.
We've been here for a very long. We kept our house for many years, and we would go back there in the summer. It wasn't as if we completely severed ourselves from Lindos, but we then sold it to the actor Nicole Williamson,
who used to come
down to Lindos quite often. That's where we knew him.
Wait. You can't just drop a name like that, because he was batshit crazy. So, do you have any Nicole Williamson stories, or drunken Nicole Williamson stories, or
I have a
homicidal?
Lot of Nicole Williamson stories. First, well, you know, a lot of them bring back fond memories. He was a terrific mimic. Do you know who Tom Lehrer was, the satirist?
First of all, Tom Lehrer is still very much, thank God, alive. But yes, he's everybody loves, of course, Tom Lehrer.
Yeah, okay.
The Massacre from Tango and National Brotherhood Week, yes, okay.
Tom Lehrer for an hour or two, all his songs. And he played piano otherwise, and he could be great company and a good friend. But when he got drunk, a different Nicole Williamson emerged. And over the years, as you and a lot of other people know, his drinking became a terrible problem. And I think really it cost him his career and led to his relatively early death. Anyway, we got to know him well because he kept coming to Lindos for many years just as a tourist. And then he finally offered to buy our house from us.
Wow.
And
do you know who owns her house now? Did it pass to family of him, or did he?
I was talking to my wife about that the other day. He had a son, so you know, I asked my wife. I wonder if his son is still going to Lindos and staying in the house. I have a feeling he probably sold the house, but I'm not sure about that. I just am not sure.
Right. Well, when was the last time you were down in Lindos, took a look around, saw your old place?
10 years.
How long?
10 years now.
Oh, 10 years, okay.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
I'd like to go back, at least for a last time, to say goodbye to the... We still have some good friends there, and that would be something I'd like to do. One factor is our daughter, who grew up in Lindos, now lives in Glasgow. She's married to a doctor in the national health system. So if we're traveling, we have to go there, and it doesn't leave so much time to get down to Greece. I don't want to go to Greece for a week. That's crazy for us. We need at least...
That's heaven for everybody else, but for you, it's nothing. That's funny.
That's nothing. Nothing at all. So that's a factor, and also we had some personal problems back here with our son that I won't go into, but
right.
that kept us from leaving L.A. for some time. And so, no, we haven't been back to our beloved village for all those years, but we have to do it at least once more.
Sounds good. Sounds good. And we're having a lot of fun talking to Willie Manischewitz here in the neighborhood. He is, of course, the author of the old book, Mata Hoople and the Pigskin Rabbi. But also, let's talk a bit about theater, because you have a play, you have a show that is running currently at the Brick House Theater in North Hollywood. The production company actually comes from New York. It's Right Act Rep. A guy named John Lant founded that.
Yeah.
And they're doing it once a week on Sunday nights at 7, California time. It's called Marlena, and I assume it's a one-woman show about Dietrich, yeah?
It's exactly that, yes. And the actress who's doing it, her name is Cindy Marinangel. She was in a previous play of mine 5 years ago called Berlin Cowboys, which took place in Berlin during the Cold War years and dealt with the CIA digging a tunnel under the lines, the demarcation lines between the Russian zone and the American, to tap into the telex and telephone lines of the Russian. It was a big thing in that time. Anyway, Cindy played the madam of a German brothel then, and she sang a couple of Dietrich songs in the course of the show, and I realized, hey, she could really do Marlena. So I wrote this play for her, and we have finally got it on, and it's running now, and it may turn up in New York. Who knows?
Oh, God willing to be. So there have been other plays, and in fact, I think there's a Marlena Dietrich show running in New York as we speak. What is your...
I think John Lant has produced it. I think it's called... what's Marlena's famous song? It's out of my head.
Oh, my God. It's Falling in Love Again. What? No?
Lily
Marlene, of course,
that's
yes.
That's not the name of it. Anyway, John Lant used to be based in Los Angeles, and he has run theaters here for many years, and he has been my main man, the guy who has really come through for me and produced a lot of my plays. He's probably produced maybe 25 plays of mine, including short pieces.
Holy crap.
Years, the past, say, 20 or 25 years.
How long ago was your first play? Because you were a novelist and a travel writer. When did you write a play?
I wrote a play, actually, probably in the late 50s or early 60s. Do you mind a Hard Luck story?
That's all I ever hear. Go.
It was a play called The Bleachers, and it dealt with the Polo Grounds bleachers, where I misspent a big part of my youth.
Uh-huh.
About the denizens of the bleachers. And then I was by then living on that Greek island, and I hardly knew anyone in the theater world anywhere except for Jack Gelber, the guy who wrote The Connection.
Yes.
I knew him, and I sent him the play, and he liked it, and he took it to Joseph Papp, who sat on it for about 2 years and then said, I know where we can do it. We're opening a sort of cabaret in our building. We'll do the play there. And just as they were starting to go into rehearsal, I got a phone call from Jack Gelber in New York saying, guess what? A group from Chicago has come into town with a play called Bleacher Bums. Same idea, bleachers out in Chicago, Wrigley Field, and that killed my play. So that was the first play I wrote, and I didn't write anything else after that until we came back to this country and I could connect with some theater people here.
So which do you like better, novels or playwriting?
You know, novels were closest to my heart, and I still care, you know, I still write short fiction, and I publish some occasionally, and I'm going to be putting some of my stories up again as ebooks soon on Amazon. But certainly playwriting has taken over from that first impetus, and almost everything serious that I write now, outside of the reviewing and so on, has been in the theater.
Now, do you have, this is an interesting thing, because you've also been writing for several years theater reviews.
Yes.
Of Los Angeles theater. Have you ever had a problem in the sense that you want to be a playwright, you're being taken seriously as a playwright, but then the other side of you is criticizing other people's plays?
Right.
Has there ever been a problem?
It does get tricky at times, and I suppose there are some producers or companies in this town who would not look at a play of mine coming from a playwright because of maybe of something I'd written in past years, a review they didn't like. But it's not a big factor. It's never been thrown in my face that, you know, you're a playwright also, and you want to be a critic. You can't do both. I think that the critical body in town, which I never joined for this reason, had a bylaw saying if you were a critic, you could not write plays and have them produced in this town.
Mm.
So I've done both, and I think it's worked, and I don't think anybody is that angry at me that I've done both.
Or speaking of anger and frustration, let's throw this back the other way and say, do you ever get jealous in the sense of going to L.A. theaters, sometimes the big ones, and seeing something that you think is a piece of dreck, and you're like, why the hell, you know, I've written better plays than that. And there's a production that cost, you know, $250,000 to mount, and here it is, and then my play's being done in a 60-seat storefront.
That's right. It's inevitable that you would think that. The situation in most of the big theaters, like the Amundsen, the Taper, the Geffen, and so on, big professional theaters, well-subsidized by private funds or foundations, they almost 90% of the time, 95% of the time, will only do something that has been successful either in New York or, say, Chicago. They don't really give local playwrights a chance. That's one of the terrible factors of being a local playwright here. So, you know, there is some resentment on the part of local playwrights, certainly for that reason. It's a rare time that one of these big theaters will do a play by an L.A. writer. And it's a big weakness, I think, that they just haven't given a home to a number of really talented people. I'm not talking about myself. But that's the reality of it, okay? So you're forced then to turn to the intimate theater scene to get your plays done.
Now, speaking of the intimate theater scene, one of the big tumultuous changes that have been happening in Los Angeles theater over the past year or two or three had to do with a decision made by Actors Equity, the actors' union, involving what actors could do if they weren't in a big theater getting paid, you know, somewhat decent actor money.
Exactly.
Quickly explain what the issue is.
For many years here in Los Angeles, by arrangement with Actors Equity, in effect, the local actors who wanted to do theater waived their rights to be paid fully. And so it was called Equity Waiver. That was the shorthand name for the situation here. And for many years, actors would work in a professional production and actually not make anything. And then Peter started paying a token sum of $7, $10, or if the play caught on, they you know, paid the actor a bit more. But it meant that a lot of plays could be done, and that's why at one time there's probably 150 theaters in L.A. doing plays, and as a playwright, you had a good chance to get something done. But as you said yourself, in the last few years, coming out of the New York office of Actors Equity, that arrangement has been overturned. And now, for most productions, small productions, the actors have to be paid from day one, beginning in rehearsal, at least $15 a day. And that's through the rehearsal period, say 6 weeks, and then the same sum for the run of the play, which is normally about 6 weeks.
And the interesting thing is that your average person who isn't a theater person listening to this might say, well, that's still not, you know, they're entitled to $15 a day to rehearse, considering the hours and the work they put in and the memorizing, and then $15.
I'm not disputing that for a second. Believe me, you know, I say this with some kind of guilt because it's not a living wage, but the reality is if you want to do theater in this town, you cannot expect to make a living out of it. That goes for the playwright as well. The only people who are making any real money are those people who own the theaters, the landlords.
Of course. Okay. Always. Oh, and that's New York, too.
Everybody else is doing it for Jesus or Moses, if you prefer.
But here's the deal. You, I think, are predicting a change then in the way small little plays and showcases are done. And not that all these theaters will just close and producers will go out of business, but
many of them are now going to hire only non-equity actors. So in effect, this ruling is going to turn Los Angeles into a non-union theater town because, you know, if you're doing a small theater production, you simply can't carry the cost of paying everybody those sums, particularly if you have a play with a cast of seven or eight. I mean, it's almost impossible to get a play with a large number of characters on, by the way. So that's why in recent years I have been concentrating on solo plays and celebrity plays. I can tell you some of the others.
Sure.
Like Charlie Parker and Lester Young and so forth. And you can get them on, whereas if you write something on a bigger scale, you've really got to fight. You've got to go outside to get money from somebody somehow, which I'm not able to do. I'm not good at that.
Well, also, though, do you think that might be a silver lining, kind of a good thing, that all these young actors who aren't dealing with a union, they just want to get up there and act and maybe be seen? Do you think it's good that you're going to get a lot of theaters that are completely non-equity?
I think, you know, there are lots of good actors out there who are not members of equity, so that gives them a chance to work. I think it's been good all around the small theater scene for actors who do want to do theater. They do have that chance. I mean, there are some actors who will never, never do small theater here. I'm not going to work and not get paid, and I understand that completely. But for the most part, whether it's non-union or working for $15 a day, it does give an actor a chance to really do what he or she was born to do and go and do some tough parts, take on things they wouldn't be able to do in television or movies. I mean, most of the actors out here, let's face it, are here to try to find work in film or TV. That's
sure.
Where the money is and the fame and so forth. But if you can't achieve that kind of success, but you're still an actor, you want to work. So you have to turn to the small theaters.
Now, speaking of film and TV, I didn't realize this, but looking at your resume, you did a bit of TV writing, including Too Close for Comfort.
Yes, I wrote a script for Too Close for Comfort, and I sold some other scripts, but I can't say I had a big career in television. I've also written some screenplays, one of which was actually sold, a couple were optioned, none of them were made. So out of frustration, I just said, look, I'll just concentrate on plays, I have a good chance of getting them on, And I couldn't do it unless I had enough money to live on, because you certainly can't live off those plays. But at this time in my life, I do have a few bucks put away, and Social Security and whatnot, and that's how I'm able to keep writing and survive.
But I don't want to leave the L.A. thing behind too quickly in terms of the TV, because when you say you wrote and sold a couple of scripts for TV, you were never in the writer's room. You just did them on spec or something? I mean, how did you go from typewriter, pull it out, and get it actually sold and done?
When I arrived, I tracked down some people who were friends of friends, who were running TV shows and so on, and tried to get assignments, and finally did. That's how I managed to sell some scripts. And with the Too Close for Comfort, I was teamed up with another playwright, a guy named Jim Gagan, who's an ex-stand-up comic and really knows comedy. So we were able to sell one script and another story outline to that show. And so, again, as a writer, the frustrating thing was when I got here, again, because I hadn't written that many plays, I was not truly that versed in dramatic writing, so to speak. I was a fiction writer. And if I knew then what I know now, I would have had a much stronger and better career in television, at least. But anyway, I had to go out and learn all these things, a different craft, different way of looking at writing between writing novels and writing plays or writing scripts for TV. And that's what I've done over the years.
Speaking of the writing of Will Manis, remember that you can go see his play, his solo show. He's not starring in it, of course, but it's Marlena, about Marlena Dietrich. It's running through the end of August on Sunday nights at 7 p.m. from the Right Act Repertory Theater, but it's being done at the Brick House Theater in North Hollywood, California. And just one or two more quick questions for Willie Manischewitz that we have on the phone with us. One of the plays that you have written, among the 25 or so that you mentioned, is called The Penis Monologues.
That's right.
Was that an answer, of course, to Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues? I mean, where did that come from?
I wrote that after seeing the Vagina Monologues. First, I was just going to write a sketch satirizing Vagina Monologues, but when I got into thinking about male sexuality, there was a lot to talk about and deal with in a dramatic way, like the whole issue of circumcision and so on. Mm. So, yes, I wrote the Penis Monologues. It was done here in an intimate theater and then went to a larger theater called the Odyssey. And it was done here and there around the country, but did not catch on in the big way that I hoped. But anyway, that's among my credits. It was also done in Europe. Mm. I should mention that the biggest success that I've had as a playwright have really been in Europe. My plays have been translated over there. And for a number of years, two of them were being done all over Europe on a pretty regular basis. And that helped keep us alive for 3 or 4 years here in L.A. So I do have an agent over there, and I still have the chance of getting the art play on in Europe.
One last question for you.
Yes.
Or feel free not to answer it, because I know writers tend to play things very close to the vest. But what are you working on now?
I am working on a play called The War Lovers, and it deals with three journalists who had been covering wars for the past 10 or 15 years over in the Mideast, who have now come back to this country and are trying to adjust to a different life and recover from the horrible trauma of being exposed to war and death and destruction for all those years. So that will be read at the Actors Studio, where I'm a member of the Playwrights Directors Unit, in the fall when we resume meeting. And that will be the first test of the script. It's only being read for the writers and directors there. So that's one play. And another, which is completely finished, and I do believe John Lant is interested in, is called Their Finest Hour, Churchill and Murrow. And it's a play about Winston Churchill and Edward R. Murrow their relationship during World War II.
Ooh.
Churchill also had a big love affair with Churchill's daughter-in-law, who later became Pamela Harriman, the famous person.
Oh, wow. All I gotta say is that if you're casting and you need somebody to play either Winston Churchill or Edward R. Murrow, or Pamela Harriman, by
a Jewish Churchill would be perfect.
Well, I think I could do it. I see myself in that role. Maybe you don't. But everybody go see Will Manis's play Marlena. It is at the Brick House Theater in California through the end of August. I want to wish you, most of all, continued health, but also continued writing and creativity in both the playwriting and the novel form. Will Manis. Oh, and the criticism form as well. Will Manis, thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood, and shalom to you.
Thank you, and shalom to you and to everybody listening.